Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is MOP 2004-04. The speaker for today is Philip Mote, and the lesson for today is Global Environmental Challenges, Solutions, Undoing Creation, Species Extinctions. Let's listen in.
First of all, I want to thank you all for coming. And second, I want to say that if you were here yesterday for the session on global climate change and you had a question that was burning and that you didn't ask, and I cut off questioning because we had to go to dinner, I'd like to encourage you to ask that now if you still remember. You know, it's hard. Yes.
Well, this kind of encapsulates the whole series that you've been talking about, but 30 years ago, we were doing studies on solar energy when I lived in Riverside, California, and there were two people that had built a hydrogen-powered automobile, and then they had a fair at Riverside Community College on solar energy, and so what's happened in 30 years?
The OPEC price shocks of 1973 really prompted the U.S. to launch research into renewable energy, and that particularly took off under the Carter administration. And a lot of that came to a grinding halt in 1981 when Reagan was inaugurated. There was substantial federal investment in solar photovoltaic, using sunlight to produce electricity directly. Also in solar heat. I also lived in California in that period. And I remember Davis, California in particular, had a lot of passive solar houses and things like that. And there were a lot of wind farms in central California, windy areas around the Bay Area. And so it really was federal investment that dried up and stopped progress in those. To some extent, that's resuming now, and one of the things the Bush administration wants to do is, and has been doing, is investing in these technologies so that they can become economically competitive with coal and other things. Wind is already economically competitive with coal, and so it can, by competing in the marketplace, it will gradually replace coal, although what's happening is it's growing only slightly faster. I mean, it's growing very fast, but only slightly faster than U.S. energy demand. So there's still a lot of new coal plants and so on going in. We'll talk about some of this tomorrow as well, but you mentioned the hydrogen fuel cell cars. It is currently possible to make a vehicle that uses hydrogen to generate electricity and run an electric motor. And some cities have hydrogen fuel cell buses.
Yes, Riverside does.
And it's very attractive because it produces no local pollution. So particularly in communities like Riverside with a history of very poor air quality, it's a good option. The problem with hydrogen is it's not an energy source. Unlike coal, if you burn coal, you get energy. Hydrogen is merely a way of transporting energy from one place to another, just like electricity and gasoline. And so you're having to invest a lot of energy to create the hydrogen somewhere, and that's through electricity. And 85% of U.S. electricity is produced with fossil fuels. So all you're doing is you're shifting the emissions somewhere else. Which in some cases is a good thing. It's the air emissions that may be of a greater concern, but as far as the climate question, they're big issues on the distribution. Just for those of you coming in, we have a slightly less content today because this is a subject that I don't understand as well as climate change, and so I'm taking any remaining questions about the stuff that I covered yesterday, since that went a little long.
You mentioned that the Bush administration is putting some money into hydrogen, alternative energy.
Yeah.
I was on the web here a few weeks ago trying to see, a few months ago, what the budget is with the Department of Energy for alternative energy, and the figures are always confusing. But as far as I could see, they were putting more money into research on fossil fuels than they were on any alternative energy. Do you know the numbers?
No, I believe that's true.
Yeah, and so and the number was amazingly low because under Carter, they were spending $1 billion on alternative energy research, and under Reagan and Bush, it went down $100 million a year to almost zilch. I don't know what it
went to. I think the current administration is spending about $1 billion a year.
$1 billion a year?
Yeah. But as you say, that's about what it was under the Carter administration.
And of course, the dollars will not be
right.
But at the Carter administration, they anybody who put in a photoelectric cell for heat or anything got a tax rebate. We are now offered a tax rebate. Only your companies are offered help. That's the difference. People, if they were given an incentive, might go ahead and try some of these things.
Yeah.
I don't mean this to be facetious, but President Bush appears to believe that global warming does not exist. Is that based upon some science and some scientific research, or is that merely a political statement?
Shortly after taking office and on the advice of several U.S. senators, President Bush convened a panel of the National Academy of Sciences to answer that very question, are humans changing climate? And in fact, the administration had a list of about 10 fairly sophisticated questions relating to climate change and human influence. A lot of the questions simply repeated questions that had been answered by the IPCC report, which I discussed yesterday, which had just come out in the early months of 2001. So in a way, it was redundant, but it reflected conservative skepticism with the wider world and the views that they might be trying to promulgate. On June 11th, 2001, President Bush stood on the White House lawn and quoted the report and he said, "We know that Earth's average temperature has risen 0.6 degrees Celsius in the last 100 years." And to paraphrase, it is likely that some portion of that was due to human influence, although we can't rule out natural variability as a cause. So in other words, his official statement in June 2001 was one of accepting the science. I think the administration recognized that they could not simply continue saying there is no such thing as global warming, which more recently Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma did say publicly last summer. He said that it was the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. Bush is operating at a higher political level and cannot get away with saying something like that, and his own scientific report did not give him room to say that. But there's still a lot of emphasis on how much we don't know, and that's been the wiggle room that the administration has used to avoid any really aggressive moves on this issue.
What do you think of nuclear power as a possible replacement environmentally?
I think we could have a long and very heated discussion about that. I have my bachelor's degree is in physics, and nuclear energy is just one of these marvels of physics at work, and so I've always had an admiration for this technology. I think that if the nuclear wastes can be safely disposed of, which is a big if. That it is a viable option for the future. It's currently expensive. Even if it were possible to permit and build a new nuclear power plant, it's by the time you factor in the life of the plant, it's probably three times as expensive as coal or wind. On the other hand, every form of energy has its downsides. And unless we dramatically curb global energy use, we have to look at nuclear and all other possibilities. And as I say, we could have a heated discussion on that. You asked my opinion, Dave.
You mentioned that the Bush administration was going to spend $1 billion a year on alternative.
That's the figure I've heard.
If, assuming some of that's hydrogen, research into hydrogen power, which is not a renewable source, but a transfer of oil fossil fuels to different use, you want to take a stab at how much of that $1 billion is really at alternative renewable resources?
My understanding was that was excluding hydrogen.
Okay. So that's a true figure.
I believe that's a true figure because it's in the Department of Energy and it's focused on developing solar photovoltaics and wind energy and other things like tidal energy. And I believe that the hydrogen fuel cell initiative is in the Department of Transportation. I could be wrong. Yes.
What's happening with
fusion? Now you're going to have to wake up the computer.
What's happening with fusion now?
Nuclear fusion, which is what powers the sun, has always been kind of the holy grail of energy, but the conditions under which it is possible are so extreme that it's always been sort of 30 years out when we might be able to get more energy out of fusion than we have to put into it. There was that 1989 cold fusion nonsense, which turned out to be some weird chemical reaction. It wasn't really fusion. It would be great if it were. I mean, that to be able to have the huge amount of energy that fusion generates without the downside of having the sun in your living room. Yes.
I really appreciated your presentation yesterday. I thought it was a great, compact way to explain the issue of global warming. Are the PowerPoint slides something that's available on, do you have a website that those are available on or anything?
Sort of. We have the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington has a sort of a collection of presentations, but it might be easier if I'm just giving my business card and you.
It would be a good way to have a discussion at our own church. Mm.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share that. Any other questions on that topic before we move on to the big kahuna? Okay, so today we're talking about undoing creation, and I use that phrase because it evokes our faith tradition that we believe that there was a creation event in which, whether it spanned a week or 3 billion years, it led to this enormous diversity of species that we have on Earth today. It's impossible to know how many species there are. It's probably somewhere between 10 and 150 million. Many of these are microbes or fungi that that cannot readily be seen, let alone identified. And so many of the things that we're losing are things that are invisible, and yet they are an intimate part of God's creation and his way of sustaining life. So, Matt, if you go to the next slide, please. This is just a quick outline. Monday, biblical perspectives on global environmental issues, and the thing that I want to stress about that as it pertains to today is that one of the clear purposes of creation is to sustain human life, and in return, one of our primary responsibilities as humans, and particularly as people of faith, is to maintain nature in what I call good working order. That God gave us this marvelous gift to provide for ourselves, and there are aspects of its function that we do not understand, and I'll come to that a little later. But we should be mindful of the way that we leave it in good working order to later generations. The two sort of atmospheric days, acid rain, ozone depletion on Tuesday and global climate change yesterday, talked about the ways that we have affected Earth's atmosphere in ways that have come back to haunt us. And in the first case, we have enacted policies that are more or less successfully dealing with those problems. On the case of global climate change, this is very much an unsolved problem. Tomorrow we'll talk about solutions to it, continuing the discussion that we've just had. So this is just a reminder, this was the acid rain problem when it was partway through being solved, the brown areas being areas where acid rain is a continuing problem and green where it's not. This was 1994. The ozone depletion problem, the poster child really being the ozone hole over Antarctica where this purple area shows very low ozone values where you would expect something more like the green And this only occurs in springtime over Antarctica. Something like the ozone hole has been observed in the northern hemisphere, but it's more of a reduction from very high levels rather than an actual reduction to very low levels. This is the history of the ozone hole from the pre-ozone hole era in the 60s and early 70s, and then you see this very striking decline really by two-thirds in the amount of ozone over Antarctica in the spring. So this is the most dramatic example of human influence on the atmosphere. Unquestionably human influence, also unquestionably will eventually recover. With climate change, as we discussed yesterday, what we've done is alter the energy balance of the Earth by increasing the amounts of various greenhouse gases. Now, before I get into today, I want to kind of put these things into perspective by talking about recovery times. How long will it take nature to undo what we have done recently? Well, in the case of acid rain, if we shut down all of the sources of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen compounds that are causing acid rain, the next day there would start to be a dropping off of the amount of sulfur in those areas. And within a week, any acid rain that had already fallen would rain out, and the rain itself would already be returning to natural levels. So that's the lowest 0 years for the rain, the precipitation, to change. Lakes and streams would take a year to 10 years to kind of get back to normal levels. But you know, clearly, and as you saw from the map on Tuesday, that is already having an effect. The 30% reduction that we've already enacted has had an effect. So that's pretty good news, pretty rapid response. Estimates are that the ozone hole should, because we've already capped the amount of chlorine in the atmosphere and it's starting to decline, that nature will slowly remove that chlorine back to natural levels, such that the ozone hole disappears in about 50 years' time from when we first really dealt with it. So that's actually only about 35 years away now. And that the whole ozone layer will recover to natural state within probably 100 years. Now, carbon dioxide cycles rapidly between the plant world and the animal world. In fact, and I didn't even really understand this until a few years ago, but the reason it doesn't matter that to global warming that we are exhaling carbon dioxide is that the carbon in our breath came from carrots and oatmeal and eggs and whatever we had for lunch, which in turn very recently came out of the atmosphere into plants. The difference is that when we drive around in cars, we're taking carbon out of the Earth's crust, which took a process of millions of years to put in. So there's a difference between this very fast cycle between plants and animals and this very slow cycle between the atmosphere and the crust. The problem is that we've elevated carbon dioxide to very high levels. Nature cannot keep up with this fast process, and it's only the slow process, which will take somewhere between 10,000 and 100,000 years to get back to natural levels. Now, we'll be able to get partway back as soon as we stop emitting extra CO2. But there is a very significant lag time. Now, when we get to today's topic of species loss, it's a whole other ballgame. Extinction is forever. This is a t-shirt that I saw on the boat on the way up here, and I asked Jake if I could take his picture, and he said, as long as you don't show my face. So here he is on the porch of Chalet 10, and that just encapsulates it, because once we destroy a species, there is no way to get it back. Some technophiles have said, oh, well, you know, we can save the DNA and clone it, like in Jurassic Park. Well, if you remember, even in Jurassic Park, the industrialists had to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to recreate a few species. And that's precisely what we would have to do if we ever got the technology to take DNA alone and clone it. It would be extremely costly. And at the rate we're destroying species, we could only restore a tiny fraction of. So, although extinction may not be forever, absolutely and for every species, for all intents and purposes, it really is. Much of what I'm going to talk about today is from this marvelous book, The Future of Life, which is at the bookstore. I really recommend it. It's a fascinating read. I'll read a couple of excerpts later. By E.O. Wilson, who's a professor at Harvard. He was still teaching when my wife and I were there. He's now retired. I think he's almost 80, still writing and speaking very actively. Marvelous thinker. His specialty is actually in ants. And we'll talk about ants a little bit later. He identifies five major causes of human damage to species: habitat destruction, invasive species, pollution, population growth, human population growth, and overharvesting. And you notice there's a convenient mnemonic here of the first letters of these. The hippo, or what he calls the rampaging monster on the land and in the water. In different situations, different aspects of these have been dominant. In some cases, it's been over-harvesting. In some cases, habitat destruction. In some cases, invasive species. And population growth is just a multiplier that drives everything else. Some examples of over-harvesting. I mean, we tend to think of, you know, the recent depletion of the global fisheries or things like that. But in fact, throughout its history, the human race has been over-harvesting. Really, at every opportunity, we've over-harvested. And there's this myth of the noble savage, you know, the Native Americans who were living in harmony with the land until we Europeans arrived. Well, the evidence is that every time natives arrived, well, we call them natives, but they were immigrants once. Every time immigrants arrived in Australia, which happened probably 40,000 years ago, the Americas 12,000 years ago, or Hawaii 600 years ago, whenever they arrived, they harvested to extinction any species that were easy to harvest. And in some cases, you know, these were flightless birds or other slow-moving animals that could fairly quickly be killed off. So we'll come to the case of Hawaii shortly. More recently, of course, many species of whales were hunted to extinction or to near extinction until a global ban on whaling was enacted, and the International Whaling Commission still is this point of many contentious battles as different nations, you know, define their harvest as research and so on. But this has at least allowed some species that were near the brink to begin to recover. Bushmeat is a term used in Africa for essentially anything that you can catch out in the bush. And as the habitat for traditional subsistence tribes has shrunk and the habitat of their prey has collapsed, they've been forced to harvest rarer and rarer animals, some of which are primates, and it just, you know, it turns your stomach to see them killing these little monkeys, but in a lot of cases, they don't have a lot of options. Traditional Chinese medicine values a lot of rare animal parts. One example is the rhinoceros horn, which is believed to have a wide range of curative properties, everything from lower back pain to laryngitis, and the combination of that, along with the Yemeni ritual, the coming of age ritual, which involves a jambia, which is a dagger made from a rhino horn, these two things have put a lot of pressure on rhinos. And in fact, the price of the black rhino horn from Africa is up to $12,000 per kilogram, which is way more than gold. So you can imagine if you're a subsistence farmer or hunter living out in the wilds of Africa and somebody comes and says, if you can get me a rhino horn, I'll pay you 10 times what you've ever made in your life. That sounds pretty good. And so that's really driven the population, that's helped to drive the population of black rhinos from 1 million 100 years ago to 2,400 in 1990 and probably lower today. So, you know, there's a whole range of different factors that can lead to over-harvesting, not simply wanting to get food. Wilson gives the example of Hawaii. Before humans arrived, it was virtually a Garden of Eden. there were a huge variety of native birds, 125 to 145 species of birds that are found nowhere else in the world. There were no mosquitoes, ants, stinging wasps, venomous snakes or spiders, or even plants with thorns. Talk about an Eden. You could walk around and nature would not harm you. This is a picture of the Moa Nalo, which is a sort of funny-looking goose-like flightless bird, which was one of these rare species of birds in Hawaii. Well, humans arrived, and after 600 years, the original population of native bird species has been reduced to a quarter or so, and of those, 24 are on the endangered list. So there are just a few that are hanging on. There are plenty of all of those nasty things, mosquitoes, ants, wasps, spiders, thorns. Of the flowering species, nearly half are alien, and those tend to be dominant. So the invaders have typically outcompeted the natives. And as Wilson says, the invasion of Hawaii is an abnormal acceleration of the Darwinian process. What he means by that is the species that are native to Hawaii are descendants of migrants that traveled thousands of miles across the ocean and landed there by happenstance, spiders and various kinds of plants and so on. And then through the process of evolution and finding new niches and so on, there's been this huge diversity. Now, these invaders only came once in a great while, and usually only in very small numbers, and they would grow only very slowly. And so the ecosystems could fairly rapidly adjust to any new invaders. But what's happened is that whole process has been multiplied in rate by hundreds of thousands of times, with new species arriving very quickly. Let's take an example of two of the worst invaders, the African big-headed ant. You can see why it's called that. The African big-headed ant, it's one of many species of ants, and these ants collectively have exterminated most native insects in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian lowlands, including a lot of the ones that pollinate native flowers. And because of their combined effects on insects and the flowers, a lot of bird species have suffered, and that's contributed to the decline in native birds. The Hawaiian environment evolved without ants, and so as Wilson puts it, Hawaii was unprepared for the shock of occupation by social predators of the caliber that ants are. It was also unprepared for ground-dwelling mammals. Before humans arrived, there were only two mammals in Hawaii, one species of bat and one species of seal. And so there were no mammals running around on the ground. Well, the early Polynesians brought pigs, very quickly of which some escaped and turned feral, and these pigs rampaged around and destroyed a lot of vegetation and outcompeted local animals. So the combined effects of the human transformation of the landscape for agriculture, which the Polynesians brought, and the ants and the pigs, have radically transformed the Hawaiian landscape, so that what is left today is just a shadow of the former biodiversity. And, I'm not pointing the finger uniquely at Polynesian immigrants. This is merely an example of what humans have done everywhere we've gone, including European immigrants to North America, which followed the Asian immigrants 12,000 years ago. Another example of some of the ways that changes can be fairly mysterious is the Vancouver Island marmot. Very charismatic creatures which are found in alpine meadows of Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Their population plummeted to only 70 wild individuals, and this was a big mystery to wildlife biologists. And as they looked into it, they figured out that what was happening was these alpine meadows, which are up at fairly high elevation on different mountaintops, occasionally be one little population in one meadow might suffer or even be wiped out, whether by a really bad winter or by some predators or whatever, or a disease. But then there would always be a few adventuresome marmots that would go down from the alpine meadow they lived in, go through the forest and find another meadow. And then they could, so they were perpetually repopulating any meadows that had trouble. Well, what happened was with deforestation, these alpine meadows, the marmots would come down from the alpine meadow and they'd get down here and they'd say, oh, okay, a meadow. And so they would populate low elevation areas that they were not ecologically prepared to thrive in. And so whether it was predators they weren't familiar with or temperatures they weren't familiar with, they simply were not making it in these artificial meadows. They were getting fooled into changing their original behavior that allowed the species to survive many thousands of years of climatic variations. One of the key factors in understanding species loss is the importance of the size of habitat. The number of species that an undisturbed habitat can support goes roughly as the third or fourth root of the area. You know, you don't need to know that math-wise what that means, but put it this way, if the area of undisturbed habitat is reduced by 90%, which has happened in a lot of places, the number of species it can support drops by half. So, you know, we tend to think of, well, we give these animals a little less space, there are fewer animals, but, you know, there will still be deer, there will still be chipmunks, there will still be frogs, you know, there will still be the same number of species. But in fact, the number of species drops as competition for resources and interactions among species changes. The example that Wilson gives is the number of reptiles and amphibians on different Caribbean islands, from largest Cuba, 44,000 square miles with 100, down to Redonda, from Puerto Rico with 3,400 and 3,400 square miles and about 40 species, Montserrat with 33 and 25 species, Saba only 5 square miles has 10, then Redonda 1 square mile and has 5 species. So this is just sort of a rough illustration of this area species relationship. And so you can sort of see that as you reduce an area, for instance, by logging in the mountains and all that's left are the national parks where no logging is permitted, then you've not merely lost numbers of animals, you've also most likely lost numbers of species as well. The biggest concern about this is in the tropical forests. The tropical rainforests only have 6% of land area, but they contain half of all known species. So these are the real biodiversity hotspots. And unfortunately, they're being deforested at a rate of between half and 2% per year. Estimates vary. So that's about 1% of tropical forest being depleted every year. And this has been going on at a pretty good clip for about the last 30 years. So do the math. Do we have centuries left before this is all depleted at current rates? No. We've already mostly logged the old growth forests in North America, but there are still some pockets that have not been logged, and those are under threat. Wetland areas where the confluence of both a land environment and an aquatic or marine environment allows a huge number of species to flourish with the interactions between, say, insects that live on the surface of the water and both the fish and the birds that feed on them. Huge variety in those places, and a lot of them are under threat through development, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. And then also the coastal zone, another unique area that's under threat from development. Well, let's talk about rates of extinction. From the beginning of the Phanerozoic period, 450 million years ago, until the rise of human civilization, roughly 10,000 years ago, the rate of species extinction is estimated to have averaged one species per million species per year. Now, the reason it's framed in terms of number of species per million per year is that we don't know within a factor of 10 how many species there are. And it's actually easier to estimate the rates of loss as a fraction of the total. So this is a fairly modest level of extinction. However, there have been several episodes where there were mass extinctions, very large numbers going extinct at once. And of course, the one that immediately comes to mind is the one 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. You know, a huge number of species of dinosaurs and also a lot of the other animals went extinct over a period of probably several thousand years following the impact of a comet in what is now Yucatan Peninsula. That's known as the Cretaceous Tertiary, or KT, extinction. And the estimate is that the current extinction rate is at least as big as the KT extinction. Now, naturally, through evolution, or God's design, or both, new species have been formed at a roughly the same rate of about one species per million per year, actually a little bit faster. So there's more biodiversity now than there was 450 million years ago. In fact, there's about twice as many species now as the average over the last 450 million years. So there's roughly a balance between natural destruction and natural creation. Does this sound familiar? The natural balance that we keep talking about between ozone production and ozone destruction, between carbon dioxide inputs, carbon dioxide outputs, and then who comes along and upsets the natural balance? Humans. So what is the current species extinction rate? Somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the background level. Let me say that again. Somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the number of species is destroyed each year under human influence as naturally occurs. This is vastly bigger proportion of impact compared with our impact on the atmosphere, where, for example, with carbon dioxide, we're adding something like 0.5% per year to the atmosphere. This is a vastly bigger rate of change. And the projection, if we keep going on this path we're going on, is that something like half of all species will be destroyed within 100 years. Now that's if we keep going as currently is happening. If we start to care about it, we can arrest that decline, and that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. All right, well, somebody said to me in the morning session, we hear these conflicts over the Endangered Species Act in the U.S. and, in the Klamath River Basin, where the need for water for the, what was it, the suckerfish or something? So that has a very non-charismatic name. Versus the farmers who are trying to make a living, and they're listening to environmentalists say, we have to save the, spotted suckerfish or whatever it's called. They're saying, why? I don't care about that fish. Who cares about that fish? What good is that fish? So even more so, these microbes or whatever that nobody's ever heard of. So what are we actually losing? Well, first of all, genetic diversity provides the raw material for evolution, for new species formation, and also for withstanding natural or unnatural onslaughts of pests. If you have a wide range of different plants, of different types of trees in the forest, and a pest comes through that targets one kind of tree, it may completely wipe out that kind of tree, but leave a healthy forest. Whereas if you have replaced that forest with a monoculture, because that's easier for the timber industry, then a pest comes through that targets that tree and you've lost the whole forest. So genetic diversity has an inherent value in preserving healthy ecosystems. The second point about genetic diversity relates to food. Our sources of food are should be especially concerning to us as the global food industry has moved toward monoculture. Just one example of that: the Irish potato famine of the 1840s. Could have been largely prevented if they were growing a variety of different types of potatoes, some of which were resistant to potato blight. And today, McDonald's has insisted that all its suppliers grow only one kind of potato, the Idaho russet. And so they have imposed a monoculture on potato growers throughout the world, because potato growers throughout the world supply McDonald's. Now what happens then is if a pest comes along that targets that kind of potato, they have to intensify the use of pesticides, which in turn breeds pesticide-resistant pests, which in turn requires heavier use of pesticides and so on. So there's this sort of cycle where when we get away from the diversity approach to food, we end up with this pesticide approach to preserving food. In 1900, there were 307 varieties of sweet corn grown in the U.S. Today, there are only 40. I'll talk in a moment about the pharmaceutical applications of nature and the values of those.
Do you have a question? So the potato company, they say that their suppliers can only grow that kind of potato?
That's right.
Or they only give them that potato?
The suppliers can grow whatever they want, but they will only buy Idaho recipes because it's easier for the processing equipment to deal with one, you know, size, shape, consistency of potato. So I'll come back to pharmaceutical applications. Another issue, air and water purification. The forests particularly are really valuable in sucking out ozone, which is a pollutant that harms human lungs. Also in purifying water, and I'll give an example of that shortly. They also cycle carbon, nitrogen, and other elements. And this is where the role of microbes that we can't see starts to become important. Because it's the microbes in the soil that are doing a lot of the nitrogen cycling that allows plants to be healthy, that allows them to produce oxygen and clean the air for us. So even the things we can't see fit into God's plan for the world as a functioning resource to provide for human needs. Some economists and biologists teamed up several years ago to estimate the total services provided to the human race by nature. And they estimated that these services were $33 trillion per year. To put that into perspective, the global economic output, the gross world product, GWP, is only $18 trillion per year. In other words, if we were to take everything we make, all the money we make, cutting down trees, turning them into buildings and paper and everything else we do, and use that money to replace the services that nature provides, we couldn't do it. Just as an example of ecosystem services, New York City's water comes largely from the Catskill Mountains. This is the Hudson River here, about 120 miles north of New York City. And you can see the network of aqueducts and pipes and so on in red. Well, in the 1990s, development in the Catskill Mountains had reached the point where the water supply was beginning to be tainted at levels that were unacceptable under federal water quality standards. And so New York City faced a choice. Do we install a filtration plant at a cost of $6 to $8 billion with $300 million of annual operating costs, or do we spend one time $1 billion to restore the watershed to its original pristine condition and let nature do the filtration? Pretty easy choice, right? $6 to $8 billion plus perpetual costs versus $1 billion. So that's what they did. They spent $1 billion to buy out farmers who were using pesticides, revert the agricultural land to forest, improve septic systems, and so on, and problem solved. Furthermore, the watershed had some of its flood reduction capability restored so that the rivers that flow out of the Catskills were no longer as much of a flood threat. So obviously, the value to New York City of the watershed was, they got a profit essentially of $5 billion plus a lot in a year. Huge value, yes?
What about the income lost from the farming?
That lost income is calculated in the value of the farm when you pay for it. So the farmers presumably can take that money and, you know, go open a souvenir shop or whatever.
What about if they're growing food? Then how do you replace the food that they're doing?
Well, that's always an issue when we talk about changing land use, and you know, when we take land out of production to build suburbs and so on, and the global land area used for producing food peaked in 1981 and has been declining, and that's an issue to be sure. But this is what, you know, these are the choices that we have to make. Do we, you know, do we pay for a plant to do the job for us, or do we have nature to do the job for us? Typically, northern farms in forested areas are not as productive as farms in lower latitudes, although that, of course, may change with climate change.
And the whole seed, I mean, the whole...
the seed provenance.
Yeah, it's just the bushels are getting, you know, you get more to the bushel now than I guess has been in the past, so...
Yeah, production per acre has been rising.
Yeah.
I just wanted to... the same question, living again in a rural area, is problem solved for New York residents about water, problem not solved for hungry people who were now have that food not accessed, and while growth per bushel is more, that's petroleum products being converted into food, and so it becomes a larger ecosystem issue for us, because I understand what you said, and I agree, and I appreciate that, but... It's a big issue.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the bottom line is how do we manage nature to meet our needs and the needs of our descendants? And you know, it might be possible to argue that this was not the right choice. I bring it up as an illustration of the value that nature provides.
But maybe we could consume this.
Well, that's what we get to tomorrow. Is really, if you look at all the options, it ends up being the only one that is really going to solve all of these problems is to start living more simply.
Well, my understanding, too, is that the government is paying farmers not to grow.
Yeah,
so
when
they're growing agricultural, too much anyway.
Oh, agricultural subsidies are just absurd in this country. Yeah. That's a whole other thing.
Actually, it'd be a pretty neat world if it weren't for humans.
Well, I would argue, and I did argue on Monday, that it was clearly part of God's design that we are on this planet, as much as we may have trammeled it, but perhaps we will have the wisdom to start untrammeling it to some extent. Let me come back to this issue of pharmaceuticals. Nature has provided the raw materials for much of what we now use as medicines. 40% of all prescribed drugs are extracted from plants, microbes, or animals. And 90%, 9 of the 10 leading prescription drugs originally came from organisms. So in other words, nature designed the drug, we figured out what uses it had, and then commercialized it, and in a lot of cases, didn't even have to make any improvements. Another example is that the ascomycete fungi have yielded 85% of antibiotics. These are very simple organisms that developed chemicals to fight off bacterial infections. And we can use those same chemicals to fight off bacterial infections ourselves. However, we only know, I mean, only 30,000 species of these fungi, but there may be 10 times as many that we don't know. Vast untapped potential. Let me give you the example of the poison dart frog, which Wilson describes at some length. There are a whole bunch of species of poison dart frogs that grow in Central and South America, and there's one that's so poisonous that if you rub an arrow, this is why they were called poison dart frogs, the natives would use them for poison. You rub an arrow on the back of one, you've got enough poison to kill 10 men.
Ooh.
Now you say, well, what good is that to medical science? Well, it turns out that the same chemical that kills people in high doses can be used to control pain in low doses. Hmm. So in the 1970s, a chemist, John Daly, and a herpetologist, I assume that's somebody who studies frogs, Charles Myers,
Reptiles,
thank you. gathered material from a similar Ecuadorian frog, tricolor, Epidobates, for a closer look at the dendrobatin toxin. They took it back to the laboratory and found that it was excellent for pain control in mice. The industrial chemists then synthesized the molecule and tweaked it a little bit so that it was a painkiller that was non-addictive, had stimulating rather than soporific effects, and did not disrupt the digestive system. Wonderful drug. They went back to Ecuador to collect more samples, and of the two habitats where these frogs could live, one had been converted to a banana plantation in the couple years since they had last done it. Now, they were able to find enough samples at that other one to collect 1 milligram, which is, you know, about the size of a crumb of toast, to take back to the lab and analyze further. Question?
How did they know if the mice had the painkiller?
that's a good question. I don't know.
That's a very good question.
I can help you out on that one, actually.
Okay.
I'm at the University of Maryland and daily work there. Actually, some of the people that are in the faculty there still work on toxins from these frogs.
Oh, cool.
It's a standard pain test. You put a mouse like on a hot plate, put some mild heat, and see how long it takes them to lift their feet. Or you can do things like put on their tail and ask, how long does it take them to remove their tail from a heated source or something like that.
Okay.
And things that work as analgesics and people do the same thing.
Whether is it stimulating instead of what? Tweak the molecule?
Stimulate instead of putting them to sleep.
That's one of the things that it did was it was a stimulant rather than a depressant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know the name of this antibiotic? I'm just curious.
Well, no, it's a pain control.
It's a pain control.
But the molecule, the synthesized molecule based on the natural molecule was named ABT-594, which you wouldn't put on a label, obviously.
It's like
Excedrin
or something.
Yeah. Anyway, so here's an example where they found a really useful drug and managed to get there just in time. As the species was losing its habitat and at a pretty good clip. He gives another example of a tree where they found a marvelous property of a chemical in one kind of tree, and they by the time they got back there a few years later, the tree had been cut down for firewood. And they searched the entire forest and could not find any other examples of that particular species of tree. So, we're kind of destroying this huge treasure trove of potential pharmaceutical applications. Nat, next slide. So to conclude, the rate of species extinction, which is driven by human consumption of a variety of goods and services, is comparable to or faster than the mass extinction that happened when the dinosaurs went under. And that alone should give us pause. In a lot of cases, we don't even know what we're losing. These microbes and so on that are probably disappearing, the species are being lost, and we don't know what function they might have, if any. But we do have some inkling just from the pharmaceutical side that the value, the monetary value, and the intrinsic value that the Bible tells us creation has is considerable. I didn't even talk about industrial applications, but there's a whole branch of materials science that looks at compounds that nature provides, everything from mollusks to frogs to plants, and the roles that those molecules play in nature, and the engineers say, I want a molecule that does that in my machine or in my application. And they are able to use the raw materials that nature provides and synthesize some kind of function as well. So there's just a huge amount of possibilities that we're only beginning to discover. And as Wilson really lays out, and as we'll discuss more tomorrow, we urgently need to preserve at least these biodiversity hotspots in the tropical rainforests. And this is where a lot of attention is being focused for a variety of reasons. But we also need to preserve the Endangered Species Act, which is perpetually under threat in the U.S., and do a lot more to enhance the appreciation for the species that we're using. So that's all I have, and I'm glad to open up for 5 minutes or so of questions. Yes.
This is biology of wine. Maybe everybody knows what me, but how distinct does one organism have to be from another to be a separate species?
Well, as I recall, and I'd be glad to be corrected, the basic question is whether two species can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. And
in their natural habitat, or under natural conditions.
Okay.
Because if you take two species and you artificially put them together, like in a zoo or something, sometimes you'll get interbreeding, that you wouldn't under natural conditions.
Okay, thank you. I had a feeling someone would know better.
Biologists even have a problem defining species in that regard, especially when we're talking about extinct. How do we know these fossils were different species?
Mm.
Because is there going to be interbreeding? And we can't
you
tell.
You can't tell just by looking at what's left. Yeah.
Is it true that the vast majority of the diversity of whether it's plants or animals or whatever is actually in the equatorial areas? I mean, in the
the
northern or southern.
Yeah, Wilson said that 50% of all species reside in tropical rainforests. 50% of all known species. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's 6% of land area for 50% of all species.
That's a global warming, it might come farther than that.
Well, in fact, it's not as simple as that. There are some species that are, constrained in their habitat by temperature, but most are not. Most are constrained by the availability of the prey or other food that they rely on, which is probably not temperature dependent. So, we're certainly going to disassemble some ecosystems and assemble new ones under a warming climate.
I have a question that's a little bit off the topic, but since you're a climatologist, can you talk a little bit about desertification and I assume there's a lot of species impact there too, but...
Yeah. That is actually a related question. Desertification simply refers to the conversion of a non-desert land area into desert, and the biggest concern is found in the southern fringe of the Sahara Desert, what's called the Sahel region. And we know that over the last several hundred years, that region has, gotten wetter and drier, and so, more productive, and then reverted back to desert. The concern is that can actually happen artificially when overgrazing suppresses plant life, which then kind of turns it into a desert, no matter what the rainfall is. And that's probably happening in the Sahel and elsewhere. And then obviously, in a desert environment, you have lower biodiversity than in a non-desert environment.
There was a
question.
Can I ask a In our area, when a builder comes in to make a suburban development and wrecks some wetlands, they let them make some other wetlands over another place. Does this make any sense? Is this an actual replacement that's helpful to biodiversity, or is this just...
I don't know. I suspect that you're not going to be able to recreate what was there, get the same collection of species to move. But it's better than just building the suburb and not trying to make it somewhere else. Does anybody know a better answer to that?
Well, usually when you do mitigation, you have to mitigate quite a bit more wetland than what you took out, 3-1, 5-1, something like that. So you may not get the biodiversity, you may get a bigger area.
Okay.
It's helpful in controlling the runoff and the speed at which it gets to, say, for instance, Lake Superior, and which keeps the temperature of that lake what it normally is, and it prevents erosion, which would come from large developments, and if it can slow the runoff, there's less turbidity in which is good for species.
This question might relate to yesterday more than today. It's my understanding that the Colorado River is producing far less water downstream than it has in the past, and the west and southwest is in dire danger of drying up. question is that my understanding is they have not used the ocean because of the cost of desalinizing the water. Isn't the time going to come when it doesn't matter how much it costs, if they're going to have to do that to replenish the water that Colorado River is not?
Yeah, the Colorado River Compact, which was drawn up, I think, in about 1925, allocated a certain amount of water to each of the roughly 10 states that lie on various parts of the Colorado and its tributaries. Unfortunately, they used 20 years of data that we now know were the wettest 20-year period in probably 500 years. So they took a piece of pie and they carved it up, and it was too big a pie. The upstream states have not been using their full share. Most of the downstream states have not been using their full share. But as Nevada and Arizona are experiencing very rapid population growth, they're drawing more and more water out of the Colorado. A lot of the water use in the West goes to agriculture. And if you look dollar for dollar at agriculture versus urban uses, you can get easily 100 times the price for urban water as you can for agriculture, irrigated agriculture. And so what that means is before they will look at desalination options, they'll simply buy water from farmers. And that's already happening in much of the West, that farmers are selling their water rights to cities because they can get more money by selling their water than they can by selling their crops. And it's, again, it's taking land out of production, and so we start to wonder, how does this play into global food scarcity? But in a market system, if food starts to become scarce, then the price of food rises, then it improves the economics for farmers. But desalination costs, something like, I forget what it is, it's on the order of 15 to 50 times what most people are used to paying for water. So it's only in very, very dry places like the Middle East.
When I lived in Arizona, I couldn't help but wonder when the irrigation process, they would run water down one row a quarter of a mile long to get that last plant a quarter mile away, and the terrible waste of water. And I wonder if the time's going to come when they're going to have to do what they do in Israel and drip. Have a drip system.
Yeah, and that also is happening in the West. Irrigation is getting more efficient because of the value of water. What the downside of that is when you flood that whole row, a lot of it soaks into the soil and replenishes the aquifer. And so then if you're pumping water out somewhere else in a well, or if that water runs back into the river, then irrigation is kind of helping the overall water cycle, the wasteful aspect of irrigation. As soon as you go to drip irrigation or lining canals and other things, you start reducing groundwater recharge, and that brings in other problems.
Well, if the market were functioning well, you'd think that instead of this option that you mentioned, that the people are buying the water, the cities, from the farmers, that the price of water in the cities went up to encourage lower consumption, particularly among the people who abuse, it seems to me, shower every twice a day all the extravagant uses of water. I mean, that's already happening to some extent, but I would think that some legislation to protect the green spaces would force the market to take that option rather than to take water away from the farmers to put to the cities, right?
In some places there is no, there's no trade-off. I mean, for instance, Seattle's water supply is in a completely non-agricultural watershed. But Seattle has found that it's been very successful at demand management, partly just by asking people to conserve. In fact, three years ago when we had a drought, and Seattle aimed at a 10% conservation rate, so they asked people, please reduce your water consumption by 10%. And the city reduced consumption by 15%, and then the water department had a revenue problem. But they've done precisely what you suggest and introduced a three-tier system. So there's, and likewise with electricity. So if you use a fairly conservative amount of water or electricity, you pay a lower rate, and then the next tier you're paying a higher marginal rate, and then the highest tier, which is really a small fraction of households, and they actually do newspaper stories about these people to shame them. You know, these rich people with huge green lawns that are eerie all the time, and swimming pools and so on. That, you know, that's been very effective in Seattle. Other places where, like Boise, where it really is, you know, the city is buying water from agriculture. A lot of what they are doing is for parks and golf courses. And, you know, outdoor water use is the huge driver. And so the way to, you know, and you drive around Tucson and there's not a lot of green grass anymore because the new developments, you know, they're fighting over a dwindling supply of water.
I wanted to give a very brief example of exactly what you were asking about. I live in the Walla Walla Valley, which is just about 10 miles of orchard area, which is like Wenatchee. And as opposed to Klamath Falls, which some of us know about, where they went to war with each other over water, essentially, about 4 years ago, the federal government came to us. We have one river that waters the Walla Walla Valley for agriculture. The federal government came and said, there's an endangered species of fish in there. You may not have water out of the river anymore, just period. Because we equate the taking of water with the taking of fish. A lot of problems with that. Number one, water control has always been a state issue, not a federal issue, so you go through a whole cycle of things. But what happened in Milton Freewater is that people decided to talk together about that. And the irrigators, irrigation community, the tribes who had interest in the salmon, a variety of federal agencies, a variety of environmental groups, largely spearheaded by the church, incidentally. I mean, my congregation, not me, the people in my congregation who are irrigators, sat down and started to talk about this. The solution, every summer it's tenuous, so the solution is we change open ditch irrigation to drip irrigation to try to save water. More water has to remain in the river every year. But they've, instead of just taking the problem and just trying to open it up a little bit to give more time for people to adapt, for the system to adapt. At the same time, the farmers know good and well when you use drip irrigation rather than open ditch that you're not really solving the problem. Or that if they can't get irrigation water to drill a well, they're taking the same water just in a different form. It's very, very complex. But I guess what I want to say is, at least in my area, everybody involved in the conversation knows the complexity, but they don't know what to do about it, but we move slowly and are keeping each other alive. But the bottom line, I think, is that either you're feeding fewer people or you're just supplying the rich folks. And while you would say the market would adapt with the water and the food, I don't think that happens. I think the market adapts only the rich people get served in the long run. I mean, when you've got food or water shortage, I think you got an overpopulation problem, the consumers, you got an overpopulation problem here. And what it seems to me is happening is the resources are shifting, but not equitably so.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to let that be the last word. I see that we're running a little behind. Thank you all for coming, and I strongly encourage you to come for the discussion tomorrow on solutions.